Welcome to the AstroCast. Welcome back to the AstroCast for episode number 2. I am your host, Rue, and I thank you very much for joining us this week. I want to just thank everyone for the awesome response we got on episode 1. I saw a lot of listeners from all over the country that tuned in for episode 1, where we discussed how to set up a beginner's rig for astrophotography, all the equipment that entails, you know, what sort of high-end, low-end, and in-between gear that you could go with. One thing that I did have a little bit of response on was the fact that I didn't deeply cover star trackers quite as much. And I, you know, in retrospect, I probably should have gone a little bit more in depth on star trackers, because they are one of the lowest cost entries to the astrophotography hobby. So I think we're going to, you know, briefly cover that today before we get into the main topic of the show. And another quick note, the intro jingle that we currently have for the AstroCast is up for grabs. I kind of just found something that I thought sounded good and went with a royalty free song to start with, but I would ultimately like to have our own custom made unique jingle for this show. Maybe it sounds a little bit spacey, maybe a little techno sci-fi kind of sound to it. So if you or anyone you know produces music and, you know, they might be able to make that jingle for me, please send me an email. That would be rue@qcrue.com. And I would love to discuss that. And maybe we could find something that works great and it can be the, you know, the new jingle for the show. So all that being said, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll discuss star trackers briefly before we get into the meat of today's episode. You are listening to the AstroCast and I'm your host, Rue. Thanks. Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Rue. You're listening to the AstroCast. And I wanted to briefly touch on star trackers, because in our last episode, we discussed building an astrophotography rig from scratch as a beginner and what equipment that needs. And I didn't really get on star trackers too much. I think I may have briefly talked about myself owning a SkyGuider Pro, which is one of the star trackers that I am going to recommend. So there's two different star trackers that are more, you know, low cost when compared to their more expensive equatorial mount brethren. And the two that come to mind are the Ioptron SkyGuider Pro and then the SkyWatcher StarAdventure 2i. So these are both Wright Ascension only star trackers. And what that means is they do not track in two axes, but only one, which is Wright Ascension. And Wright Ascension, if you don't know, is basically the rotation that you see the stars appear to take overnight. So as they move, you know, from east to west over our heads, it's actually, you know, the Earth is rotating, obviously, but it appears that the stars move from east to west over our heads. What a star tracker does is it tracks that movement for you overhead. So one of the, you know, absolute lowest cost ways to get into astrophotography is, you know, a lot of people have a DSLR or mirrorless camera already that they already have. And if you have a, you know, a really good sturdy tripod, then all you really need to add to that equation to take long exposure astro shots is a star tracker. So bare minimum, all you need is a tripod and a camera. You could take some, you know, short exposure photos with those and then stack them on top of each other, or just take one single shot if you like. But if you want to start to bring out more detail, see some of those deep sky objects, you're going to want to take, you know, 30-second exposures and then stack them on top of each other. I have seen people take successful, you know, 2-second exposures and then stack, you know, 500 of them and they bring out, you know, some detail. But I personally have never done that myself. I've taken, you know, many a time lapses with just a tripod and a camera, you know, a tripod, a DSLR or mirrorless camera, and a star tracker will get you, you know, a base entry into astrophotography. And from there, you know, you can add on various things. You could decide, you know, at some point in the future, hey, I want to, you know, go to a full equatorial go-to mount. So for me personally, what happened is I had finished building my main rig, which is the one that we discussed last week. the 448 millimeter SV Boney 80ED doublet scope that I have on top of the Ioptron CEM26. And I was taking a trip to a dark sky site last summer, and I wanted to have a secondary rig that I could take really wide field shots with. So my plan was to use my Canon R7 camera in combination with a really popular lens, which is the Rokinon 135 millimeter lens. So that's a manual only. It's a very inexpensive buy, you know, camera lens standards lens that works just wonderfully for astrophotography. And I wanted to, you know, combine that with my Canon R7 and then have a star tracker that I could, you know, pop it onto and then get shots of the night sky with. So in doing so, I ended up actually purchasing a Skyguider Pro, and I paid $398 for it from High Point Scientific. I did need a more sturdy tripod for it. They actually make one specifically for that star tracker that's about $100. Actually, in this case, let me take that back. I already had a tripod that my wife had gotten me for Christmas, and it worked quite well with the Skyguider Pro. So I was able to use that because I had a sturdy tripod. I got the Skyguider Pro. I put my Canon R7 on it, and I was able to take some really awesome wide field shots. And I was able to actually swap out that Rokinon 135 for a Canon 16 millimeter lens that I also had to take really wide shots of the night sky, you know, something that could capture several constellations, you know, at the same time together, which is really cool. So if your budget, you know, is under $1,000, then you should look into star trackers for sure, particularly if you already own a DSLR or mirrorless camera. If you do, then man, it's almost a no-brainer to look into something like the Skyguider Pro. I actually recommend the Skyguider over the Star Adventure 2i. I feel like the quality is better. I love that it has an internal battery, a very long-lasting internal battery too. It'll last you, well, me personally, it's lasted me two nights of sessions that were, you know, 6 hours long each. The only downside, I think the charging cable is mini USB, which is a really outdated standard. I wish that was a Type-C charger. But other than that, the quality is great. It comes with a counterweight bar and a counterweight. So you don't have to use the counterweight if you're using a, you know, just a camera with a smaller lens on it. You know, if it's under, I think it's under 3 pounds, 4 pounds, there is no need to put a counterweight on it. But if you want to, you know, approach the, I believe, 11 pound payload capacity, then you'll definitely want to put that counterweight bar on. So definitely worth considering Star Adventure 2i or Skyguider Pro. Out of those two, again, I would recommend the Skyguider Pro. Another thing to keep in mind, if that's your budget, you are just about $300. If you already have a tripod, $250 away from the next level up, which would be a Star Adventure GTI, which is actually, they call it a star tracker, but it's truly an equatorial mount, and it has go-to capabilities, and it's just got a ton more functionality built into it. So I would recommend that over the Skyguider Pro or the Star Adventure 2i, just because it has so much more functionality, and it's only, you know, $200-$300 more expensive. But it just depends on what your budget is. You know, I started with the Skyguider Pro. I eventually purchased a Star Adventure GTI as well. So, you know, in total, I have three astrophotography mounts. I've got the CEM26, Star Adventure GTI, and a Skyguider Pro. So they all have their own uses. They all have their own pros and cons. The Skyguider Pro is just so portable. I could take it anywhere with me. It's just, you know, basically a little cube that I can throw in my bag, and it's good to go. Whereas the, you know, Star Adventure GTI, while it is small, it's not as small as the Skyguider Pro when it's all packed down, and I pretty much have to have a counterweight with it because I do put a bigger load on it, but I can auto guide with it. I can, you know, set a much higher focal length on it. I can use go-to capability. I actually run an ASIR mini on that device. So, you know, everything can be ran right through my phone or tablet, which is super cool. So that's about it in terms of star trackers this week. I just wanted to, you know, take a few minutes to cover that, since we didn't get too in depth on it last week. So I hope that answers, you know, some questions that, you know, came up, and we'll be back after the break and we will go ahead and dive into the meat of today's episode. You are listening to the AstroCast. I'm your host, Rue, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the AstroCast. I'm your host, Rue. Thank you again for joining us this week. Today, what I would like to discuss is something that is very near and dear to me and to many astronomers that I know as well, and that would be dark skies. So, unfortunately, if you live in the United States, you are among the 99% of the population that lives in a light polluted sky where the Milky Way is not visible to the naked eye. And this is something that is just extremely disappointing to me. And what boggles the mind is light pollution is the only type of pollution out there, well, next to sound pollution, I suppose, that is completely reversible and instantly reversible. If all we did was turn off our lights, you know, once, you know, for new moon, perhaps, everybody would be able to see the Milky Way with their own eyes. The ancients had such a better view of the night sky than we ever did, and perhaps that's why there was, you know, so much amazing work that came out of that period of time, because when they walked outside and looked up, what they saw was breathtaking compared to what the average person who lives in the suburbs of the United States sees today. Me personally, I grew up in an area that had relatively dark skies, and I'm going to discuss the Bortle scale, which is a rating scale that tells you how dark the skies that you live in are. I come from an area in Charlotte, North Carolina, currently that is a Bortle 6 and borderline 7. So, you know, by no means is it a dark sky site, but, you know, I do the vast majority of my astrophotography from my front yard in Matthews, North Carolina. And it really stinks that I can't see the Milky Way with my own eyes from my front yard. Now, that being said, I am quite lucky in that if I drive an hour south to our observatory, which is the Gale Rigsby Observatory in South Carolina, which is the home base for the Charlotte Astronomers Club that is ran by a friend of mine by the name of Rick, who I hope to have on the show one day, but that's a topic for another time. I am able to see the Milky Way, and it's quite incredible. So to give you a little bit of a background, after I got into astronomy post-pandemic and really started paying attention to the night skies, I pretty quickly realized, you know, the light dome coming from Charlotte and the light dome coming from Concord in the area that I was in was just, you know, really disappointing. And the more that I looked at the stars and the more knowledge that I gathered, the hungrier I became for seeing those truly dark sights. So I wanted to take a trip over the summertime to somewhere very dark, and I did that. So me and my oldest friend in the world, his name's Chris, we decided that we were going to, you know, pack up and take a trip out to our very first Bortle 1 dark sky site. And we did that. We did it in June of last year. So about, 8 months ago now, we took that trip. And I have to tell you, it was nothing short of a spiritual experience seeing the Milky Way for the first time. It was completely and utterly breathtaking. I think when we first got there, I had a hard time even setting up my telescope because my jaw was just, you know, resting on the floor while I was staring up into the night sky. I was just completely in awe of it. Here I was 38 years on the planet Earth, and never had I seen the Milky Way. And it made me think instantly about how many people are out there that will never have the chance to see the Milky Way. You know, they might not think, hey, I should take a, you know, a trip out to a dark site, or perhaps they are at a dark sky site and it just doesn't occur to them to even look up. I can tell you after thinking back on it, I have made trips to places that are very dark and very remote when I was growing up and in my 20s, and it never occurred to me to just look up at the night sky and see what's up there. Had I seen the Milky Way back then when I was, you know, 12 years old out in Utah in the middle of nowhere, I probably would have just thought it was a little cloudy out, honestly, because I didn't know what I was looking for. But anyway, so we made the dark sky trip out to the, you know, Bortle 1/2 site. It's Bortle 1 if you were facing southeast, and I would say Bortle 2 if you were looking to the northwest. So basically the Milky Way overhead, though, was incredible. And the difference between seeing the night sky in a place like that versus a place like where most of us live, which is, you know, the suburbs outside of a major city, is just, I hate to use the phrase night and day, but it truly is night and day. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. The number of stars that you see overhead in the night sky is just breathtaking. When you look directly overhead at the zenith, which is the spot that is directly overhead when you're looking up at the night sky, it's so dark. It's a dark unlike anything you've ever seen. And it looks like a million diamonds have just been thrown onto a black velvet blanket and they're just glistening up there under the night sky. And you can see so many more stars than you could ever possibly see in an area like Charlotte. And it took my breath away. So we ended up spending a total of 3 nights there and loved every minute of it. We got very lucky with the weather. It wasn't windy out. The first night, I remember there was a really big storm and, you know, we had a hotel room that was about 2 hours drive away from the actual dark sky location where we were setting up. And both of us were like, should we even go? I'm not sure. The storm's really bad. And we didn't want to be isolated out in the middle of nowhere. You know, if it was going to be thunderstorming all night, but lucky for us, we said, nope, you know, we came for this one thing. We're only here for 3 nights. Even if, you know, we get stuck and it just rains all night, we're going to at least try. So we went. It took us about, you know, 2 hours to get there. And once we arrived, we were quite blessed in that, you know, the storm had passed and we looked up and there it was. And it just looked so incredible. The first thing I noticed was the place where the Milky Way splits. It appears to converge from 2 separate Milky Way areas into 1. And that continues to go directly overhead all the way up to the zenith and then all the way back down to the other side of the horizon. And it's just, gosh, it was so beautiful. I had tears in my eyes when I was staring up at it. And all I could think to myself was, man, it's so disappointing that other people don't get to see this with their own eyes. And why I'm talking about this so much today is I want to really encourage any of our listeners that have not made a trip to a dark sky site to really truly try your best to make that trip. I know it is not easy for everyone to do, but I would be willing to bet that most of us, you know, are probably within a few hours drive of at least a Bortle 4 site, and you can see the Milky Way from a Bortle 4 sky. So it won't be as breathtaking as what I saw out in a Bortle 1. I'll give you that. But seeing it at all is something that just completely changes your view of the night sky. So since we're talking about dark sky sites, we probably should discuss the Bortle scale because I've mentioned it several times up till now. And I'm thinking that some of you may or may not know exactly what I'm talking about when I'm referring to the Bortle scale. So what the Bortle scale is it is a scale based on the numerical values 1 through 9, where 1 is the absolute darkest, best skies that you can have, you know, Chile at, you know, 4,000 feet elevation, that kind of dark sky site, all the way up to 9, where that would be, you're in the middle of Manhattan in Times Square, and there's just so much light pollution that all you can see maybe are the brightest planets, and that's about it. Most of us, I like to think, are living somewhere between the 5 and 7 range. Suburban skies are technically 5, but you know, most of the places that I see in the suburbs are closer to 6 or 7. And me personally, like I said earlier, I have about a 1 hour drive to get to a 4, which is dark enough to actually see the Milky Way. But you don't get that beautiful, detailed, almost ivory-like structure, or not ivory, marble-like structure of the Milky Way, but you can see it. So, you know, what does that mean to you? Well, I would recommend going on a light pollution map. I believe it's lightpollution.info. All right, that is lightpollutionmap.info. And this is an absolutely excellent tool that you can use to figure out, you know, what boreal area you are in personally, and also use it as a tool to find out where you can go to get to a darker sky site. So what you'll notice when you're looking at this map is that the brighter areas, you know, the boreal 6, 7, 8, 9, they're going to appear red all the way up to purple, where they're at the absolute brightest. And then the darker skies are going to start at a yellow and then gradually turn to green. And then if you get out to a really dark sky site, it's going to be blue. So I can tell you, anywhere on that light pollution map that is green, you should be able to see the Milky Way from. If you, you know, give your eyes 10 minutes to adjust and you don't have any, you know, street lights directly around you, turn all the lights off. It really does make a difference. Put your cell phone away. And if you're in one of those green areas on that map, then you should be able to see the Milky Way. So I would encourage any listener that has not seen it with their own two eyes to, you know, take yourself, grab a friend or a family member, and just, you know, go during new moon. This is something we'll discuss here in a moment. And you want to take a trip out to that dark sky site. And, you know, go, if you're in the northern hemisphere, you want to go during the summertime. So June, July, August, you know, around then, that's when the Milky Way is up. Its brightest part anyway, the core of the Milky Way is up during that time of the year. And, you know, plan on going for a few hours and just look up. Maybe you could even go during a meteor shower. That's something really fun to do. If you can, you know, find one that's happening, you know, near new moon, that's a great time to go. But even if you can't find a meteor shower, plan on going around new moon to see the Milky Way. How I planned my trip last summer that we took, I looked at the moon calendar. There's several online that you can find. I actually have a printed poster that I keep up on my wall that shows the phases of the moon throughout the year. The moon cycles in 28-day increments, so it does not match up to our month. So, you know, that it slowly changes over time. But new moon, you know, every 28 days it happens. And if you can go, you know, from the week before up to the week after new moon, you're going to have much darker skies, and it's going to just be a, you know, much better treat for the eyes. If the full moon is out, it's so bright that if you're in an area like a boreal 4 or 5, it's likely going to be too bright, and it's going to, you know, make the Milky Way disappear. It is very faint. It's a delicate white color, and moon glow is extremely bright. So it can kill, you know, any visuals that you would have of it. I can't say from a boreal 1 site what it looks like when a full moon is out, but I would be so disappointed if I got all the way to a boreal 1 and it was full moon. I think that would break my heart. So don't ever do that. If you get a chance to go to a boreal 1, make sure you do it during new moon. I would challenge any listener this upcoming summer, you know, like I said, June, July, August, look at your calendar, look at the moon calendar, and find out when you can go and see a dark sky with your own eyes. And I just want to hear back from you. Let me know, you know, if it was a spiritual experience for you like it was for me. I am not a very I'm not a religious person, I should say. That's not to say I'm not spiritual at all, but I'm definitely not a religious person. But man, that shook my foundations. It really did. So I want as many people as possible to be able to experience that. And that's why I'm recommending it so hard. So we're going to take a brief break here on the Astrocast. And when we get back, we're going to talk about the other topic that I would like to discuss this week. I am your host, Rue. Thanks for listening, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Astrocast. I am your host, Rue. Thanks for tuning in this week. We were just discussing dark skies and how important it is for everyone to be able to visit Bortle 1 skies at some point in their life so they can see the Milky Way with their own eyes, and just what a life-changing experience that was for myself when I first got to do it over last summer. So we're going to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about something a little bit different that is obviously highly astronomy related and is actually quite a bit related to dark skies as well. So what I want to talk about is constellations, actually. So constellations is something of an enigma to me, because when I was younger, I would hear about constellations. You know, you heard about the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and maybe the Seven Sisters, which I know is an asterism, but, you know, we thought of it as a constellation when we were kids. And I couldn't really make sense of any of it. Before I got into astronomy, I had a hard time understanding how anyone could look up at the stars in the night sky and see pictures of them. It made just absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. And then as I got a little bit older, I was able to pick out one. And I'm willing to bet that this is the same constellation that most of you were most likely able to pick out first. And that was, of course, Orion. So Orion's belt, it stands out very much in our night sky because of Alnitak, Alnilam, and Mintaka all being lined up the way that they are. It just pops out at you. So it's a very recognizable, easy to find subject in the night sky. One thing that I have challenged myself to do over these last few years is try to learn a new constellation every season. You know, that might sound trivial, but once you learn quite a few constellations, as I have over the last 3 years, it becomes anything but trivial to try to learn a new one every season. So, you know, in the summertime, the first constellation that I was able to learn was Cygnus the Swan. So that one stuck out to me. It's one of the easier constellations to find in the summertime. It's right overhead. It's beautiful. The three stars with, you know, Sator in the middle, they really do appear to stand out to you. And it does somewhat resemble a swan. In the winter, obviously, Orion was the first constellation that I learned. And honestly, it was the first constellation that I learned names of stars within as well. I knew a few stars. I knew Vega. I knew Betelgeuse. And that might have been it for many years before I was, you know, big into astronomy. But now I can name pretty much every major star in Orion. And I think it's one of the more fascinating and fun to learn things about the night sky is learning constellations. I love whenever I have my nephew up from New Orleans. Anytime he comes by, he's younger, he looks up to me, so he loves anything that I'm into. So I'll drag him outside and I'll show him a constellation and tell him what it is. I really enjoyed, after learning about Orion and memorizing some of the stars, you know, Betelgeuse, Bellatrix, Rigel, Alnitak, Alnilam, Mintaka, so on and so forth. I love the painting of the winter night sky. And it's a scene that we all see, you know, time and time again as winter comes. And that is Orion battling Taurus, who appears to be protecting the Seven Sisters of the Pleiades, who's looking over them, but Pollux and Castor, you know, the twins of Gemini. So you can always tell what time of year it is, you know, depending on which constellations are above you in the night sky. And a friend of mine who's not really big into astronomy, but, you know, he has a passing interest in space, had mentioned to me that, you know, he would have a hard time finding north and south in the daytime, let alone at night. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, and I was like, you know, I know the sun obviously rises in the east and sets in the west, so you can find north or south, depending on what time of day it is, fairly easily. But for more specific directions, as far as, you know, north, south, west, east, northeast, southwest, et cetera, I think I could find my way around in the night sky a heck of a lot better than I could by just the sun, because Polaris is always super easy for me to spot now that I've been doing this for a few years. And once I find that, I feel like I've got my bearings. And if I know roughly what time of year it is, you know, I know I can look over to my right and see Orion, or I could look to my left and see Vega, you know, starting to set lower on the western side of the sky. And this time of year, this year, Jupiter is, you know, directly overhead in the evening sky, which is really cool. And then once summer rolls around, the same thing holds true. You know, we start seeing, you know, Cassiopeia rise. We've got the Swan Cygnus, like we talked about earlier, directly overhead. The more I learn, the happier I am. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to dive a little bit deeper into constellations when we get back. You are listening to the Astrocast. Thanks so much. Be right back. Welcome back to the Astropod. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Rue. And before the break, we were discussing constellations and how we can go about trying to learn new ones every season, which is something that I found particularly fun to do over the last couple of years. As we do astrophotography, we all know that some seasons are better than others. A lot of friends of mine love summertime when it comes to astrophotography, because you've got the core of the Milky Way out and all of the wonderful targets that go with it. Obviously, wintertime is great. For me personally, I think winter might be my favorite season for astrophotography, because my favorite constellation, Orion, is out at that time. And I love shooting Orion. I love shooting the Rosette Nebula and all the other awesome targets that we have available during that time of the year. However, with that being said, for someone like me who only owns, you know, wide field refractors, spring is not the greatest time in the world to do astrophotography, unless, you know, you like shooting tiny galaxies, which I can't do very well right now with my current setup. It was at that time last spring that I decided to really start studying the night sky and trying to learn all the different constellations that come and go. So at first, when I decided to take on this endeavor, I was very lost in the night sky. I knew a couple of constellations, but, you know, just the major ones that, you know, even people who aren't into astronomy would know. But it was springtime, so it was galaxy season, and I, you know, don't have a rig that is well equipped for shooting galaxies. And I still want to be out under the night sky, you know, doing something productive, learning something, taking photos of something, etc. And it was at this point that I looked up and I noticed a very peculiar shape in the night sky. It looked like a sickle. The shape of the stars was just thrown up in such a way that it really did resemble a sickle. And then I also noticed a few other stars from the backside that looked like hind legs. So I was staring at this object in the night sky, and I thought to myself, surely this is an animal. So I opened up an app on my iPhone called Sky Safari Pro. If you don't have it, I highly recommend it. It is an excellent app for looking up constellations, deep sky objects, picking out targets for the night, etc. There's a lot of apps on iPhone and Android that you can use, but I personally prefer Sky Safari Pro. So I pointed my phone up at this constellation, and it was, of course, Leo the Lion. I was just kind of blown away by how much the shape of stars that I was staring at resembled the actual animal. And I decided at that point that I understood completely why the ancient people picked out the names and animals, objects that they did to name these constellations, because they truly do resemble what they are named after. And as silly as that sounds, and I know that kind of sounds like a duh moment, all I could do was think back to my, you know, 8-year-old curious self who would stare up at the night sky and wonder, how on earth did these people come up with these names? And what do you mean this looks like a hunter? What do you mean this looks like a snake? What do you mean this looks like a lion? And it all kind of clicked for me at that point that, okay, no, it does look like a lion. It does look like a snake, et cetera, et cetera. So with that being said, I knew that I wanted to learn more of the constellations. I think a lot of people start with the zodiacal constellations just because they're the most popular and it's an easy way to kind of track what time of year it is on the night sky. I didn't personally go that route. I wanted to learn, you know, whatever stood out to me. Whenever I would walk out and look up, I wanted to, you know, see something coming up on the eastern horizon that caught my eye, and that was what I wanted to learn. So I have a rule where every season I try to learn one new constellation. I know that might not sound like much, but there aren't a ton of constellations in the night sky. And in fact, there are only a total of 88 constellations. And in the northern hemisphere where I reside, there's only 30 visible constellations, 5 of which are visible all year long. But yeah, only 30. So if you do the math and you only learn one a season, that's, you know, 4 a year. Over the next decade or so, I should learn them all. But, you know, in reality, I learn more than one per season because I look up at the night sky nearly every clear night that I get. And my naturally curious mind is going to open up that Sky Safari app and scan the horizon to see what's what. So I've learned quite a few constellations over these last couple of years since I started. We'll go over those when we get back from the break, and I will give you a few tips for what I've done to learn mine. Thanks for listening to the Astrocast. I'm your host, Rue, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Astrocast. I'm your host, Rue. Thank you for joining us today. We're discussing constellations and how to go about learning them. And I figured we could start with just a basic premise, which is, you know, which season is it when you're looking at the night sky? So if you're brand new to astronomy, you may or may not know that certain constellations are not visible at certain times of the year. So depending on if you're in the northern or the southern hemisphere, you know, north of the equator or south of the equator, that will determine what is visible for you during, you know, any time of year. So, and just generally speaking, let's say for our purposes that we have 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night. If you can picture this and then picture the equator, you could imagine that in 12 hours in the winter, you have this portion of the sky. And then in 12 hours of the summer night, you have that portion of the sky. For me, I feel like the winter constellations tend to stick out a little bit more. My brother once said to me, you know, nothing stands out quite as much in the night sky as Orion. And I tend to agree. Orion's belt is something that is very easy to spot in the night sky, just the way that Alnitak, Alnilam, and Mintaka line up perfectly one after another. It's extremely visible. And you also have Sirius in the area, which is the brightest star in our night sky. So it's just a very visible constellation. And I think it's one that most of us start with. So in that particular part of the night sky, I tend to picture an image in my mind when I'm looking at it, which is, you know, Orion fighting Taurus and then kind of all the spectators that are around in the area. So if we start with Orion, obviously you have Betelgeuse, Alnitak, Alnilam, Mintaka that kind of make up the bright stars right in that area that make it easy to spot. And then directly to the right of Orion is going to be Taurus. If you start with these two constellations, you'll quickly see all the others kind of fall into place. You have the Pleiades behind Taurus, or kind of in the middle of Taurus. Technically, the Pleiades isn't a constellation, it's an asterism, but I always think of it, you know, in terms of winter constellations. So in that part of the night sky, we're going to have Perseus, Andromeda, Taurus, Orion, Gemini, Monoceros, Canis Minor, and Canis Major, which, you know, obviously has Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky. So these are the winter constellations that I have been able to learn thus far. Again, I started with Orion and kind of built around that and slowly discovered more and more as I went on. Now, as far as the summer constellations are concerned, I still have a little bit more to learn. Thus far, I have learned, let's see, Cepheus, Auriga, Cygnus is a big one that stands out, the swan. So in the middle of the summer, Cygnus is going to be directly overhead, which is just a beautiful sight to see. And it does really resemble a swan. We have Cassiopeia, of course, which was one of the first constellations that I learned as a child. But I didn't know that it was Cassiopeia. Like probably many do. We thought of it as a W or the mountains in the night sky, as it kind of resembles a mountain range. And then, of course, we have Hercules, Ophiuchus, which is a really beautiful constellation near the core of the Milky Way, which also includes one of my all-time favorite nebula regions, which is Rho Ophiuchus. Forgive me if I mispronounce that. And then Scorpio, of course. So that would be a pretty much a, you know, long list of everything that I have learned thus far. I still do have some of the smaller constellations to learn, but I've, you know, like I say, I started 2 years ago and I can point any of those out in the night sky. What I would recommend to any beginner would be to download, you know, an app on your phone, find a bright set of stars that really stands out to you that is predominant on the eastern sky and, you know, slowly raising up to the zenith overhead as the night wears on. What I wouldn't recommend doing would be finding something low on the western horizon. Like right now in the winter, I guess, not right now, but you could have seen Cygnus, a few weeks back, low on the western sky. That's not a good way to learn because it's going to quickly fall below the horizon and you won't be able to see it. So try to start in the eastern sky, view something that's rising and coming up, so that way throughout the night you can reference it. That's how I learned Cygnus, and that has served me very well. So SkyMap is another one that you can use. It's a lot more basic, but you know, sometimes simple can be good. Sky Safari, as I said, I use the Pro version, which includes just a lot more data, which is great. And then Stellarium, which is probably one of the best planetarium softwares that you can find on PC, makes a mobile version as well. Stellarium Mobile, that can be quite great to use. But again, I've tested pretty much all of the apps for smartphones, and my favorite would be Sky Safari Pro. So that would be my recommendation to you. So that's going to cover constellations. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we're going to finish up this episode with a little bit of discussion around astrophotography. My name is Rue. You are listening to the AstroCast. Thanks so much. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the AstroCast. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Rue. Today we've been discussing constellations, and for the last portion of the show, I'd like to discuss something that I thought about after recording last week's episode and figured we should probably get into a little bit. So what we discussed last week was beginner astrophotography setups and what they consist of. However, after giving this some thought after recording the episode, it occurred to me that there isn't even more basic setup that we can use for folks who maybe don't have the most money to get started. There is a even more simple piece of kit. And what I'd like to do is just go over what that consists of and give you a couple ideas for how you could use it. So before, we talked about star trackers, such as the Ioptron Skyguider Pro and the Star Adventurer. We also talked about full-blown equatorial go-to mounts. I discussed at length the CEM-26, and we also talked about the AM-5. But there is a sect of astrophotography that does not require a star tracker. You can indeed do unguided short exposures, and depending on, you know, what focal length you're using, that could be anywhere from a 1 second exposure all the way to as high as 15 seconds of exposure. And what this requires is really very simple. All you need is a tripod and a camera. That's it. What kind of camera, you may ask? I would say ideally a DSLR or mirrorless camera. Something with a wide field lens would be ideal. But you could also do this with an iPhone or a Samsung or whatever type of phone that you have. All you need to do is keep the phone very, very still, hence the tripod, so you can do long exposures without having the stars get all shaky in the night sky. So I told you I would give you an example of something that you can do using these simple tools. And I'm going to tell you one of my absolute favorite things to do, which is a time lapse of the night sky. So with just a tripod and your camera, what you could do, I'm going to give you an example using something like a 16 millimeter lens and a Canon mirrorless camera, which is something that a lot of people might have. You could use something like a Rebel T7, I believe is the more recent Rebel camera, or any of the R series cameras that are the mirrorless Canon cameras. So you want to go ahead and set up your camera on your tripod, and you want to put the mode of the camera into manual mode. So from here, there are three different settings that you'll want to tweak. And if you don't know anything about photography, I'll try to speak this in the simplest terms I can without getting too in depth on what each of them means, because that could be a whole other episode that we could, you know, talk about. But for now, we're going to talk about the exposure length or shutter length. We're going to talk about the f-stop of the camera, and then we're going to talk about the ISO. So to get started, if I was using a 16 millimeter lens currently in the winter night sky, I would like to maybe point it in the direction of Orion, and I would like to set the shutter length to 15 seconds. I would make the f-stop the lowest number possible. So if I've got a 16 millimeter lens, it's not uncommon for that to have something like an f1.8 f-stop ratio. So you want to open that up. What the f-stop means, just very briefly, is how wide the camera lens opens up. So how much light it can let in at any given time. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, because the lower the number, the wider the aperture. So if you add f10, that would be a very small amount of light getting in. Whereas if you had F2, that would be a very large amount of light getting in. So regardless of which lens you're using, go ahead and set that down to as low as you can get it. Now, you might want to do what's called stopping down the lens, which would be to take it from, let's say, F1.8 up to F2.4 if your stars come out a little bit bloated, and we'll get into that in a moment. But for our initial test shots here, let's go ahead and open up that aperture as wide as it can go. So we're going to do a 15-second exposure. We're going to do f1.8, and then let's set our ISO. For starters, let's set it anywhere from 1600 to 3200. This is going to vary a lot from camera to camera. Some cameras get excellent results with a low ISO, you know, 400 to 800 for something like this. My Canon R7, I like to go a little bit higher with the ISO. I'll do 3200. If I'm doing Milky Way photography, I might even do, you know, 6400. It really just depends. So for our test though, let's go ahead and set that to ISO 1600 to get started, a 15 second exposure at f1.8. Now what you're going to want to do is go into your camera's menu, and I want you to find a delay for the shutter. So you should have a countdown feature in your camera where it'll either, like a Canon will count to 2 or even 8 before it snaps the photo. And the reason we want to do this is we're going to press that shutter button down, and we don't want to shake the camera while we're taking the picture, because we want the stars to be as sharp as possible. So we're going to set a 2 second delay on that shutter from the menu. So go into your menu, find the shooting mode options, and then you want to set it from either, you know, low speed or high speed. You want to set it to delay of 2 seconds. So once we have that done, we should have all of our settings ready to go. We're at ISO 1600. We've adjusted the shutter speed to be 15 seconds, which means that shutter is going to be open for 15 seconds exposing. And we have got that f-stop at 1.8. So we're letting in as much light as possible. So once we've got all that done, I want you to go ahead and focus your stars. You might want to put your camera into manual focus mode at this point. You're going to have to, depending on your camera, you might be able to do it from your quick screen, you know, right on the home menu. You might have to hit a switch on your lens. Some of my Canon lenses require you to, you know, switch it over to focus mode and then adjust. But you should have a ring on your lens that allows you to adjust the focus. And what you'll want to do is zoom in on one of the brighter stars on your screen on your camera, and just, you know, get in as close as you can, like 10x or what have you. And then I want you to adjust that focus ring until you can get that star as small as possible. Now, after you have that done, we've got our delay set up. We've got all the settings correct, and we've got our stars focused. I want you to go ahead and press that shutter button. You're going to hear a 1-2 countdown, and then boom, it's going to start recording, okay? And it's going to expose for about 15 seconds. After that, go ahead and review your image. And a good idea here would be to zoom in on the stars, have a really close look, and make sure that they aren't trailing at all. And what I mean by that is make sure that the star still looks like a star and not like a small line of light moving from, you know, east to west on your screen. So if you notice that the stars are trailing at all, what you want to do is go ahead and reduce that shutter time. So instead of 15 seconds, let's try 12 seconds. And then go ahead and take that shot again. Then you want to zoom in on the stars and see if it's solid. If you're still getting trails on your stars, just keep reducing that shutter time until you notice that they are not trailing anymore. If you're using a, you know, a longer focal length lens, so let's say maybe you're not using a 16 millimeter lens, but you're using a, you know, 135 millimeter lens, you're not going to be able to take as long of an exposure as you would with that wider lens, because the stars are going to apparently move much faster over the night sky. You know, obviously the Earth is turning, but if the stars are moving faster because you're zoomed in on them closer, you need to lower down that shutter speed. And it can vary anywhere from, you know, depending on your focal length, 2 or 3 seconds, all the way up to, you know, 15 seconds or even more to avoid star trails. So after you've done this successfully, what you want to do is go back into your drive mode settings where we set that 2 second delay. And a lot of cameras are going to have a feature that is built into them that allows them to take one shot after another. This functionality is referred to as an intervalometer. And you can actually buy an external one from your camera, which is a really good piece of kit to have. They're very inexpensive. You can get one for about $20 on Amazon. And what this allows you to do basically is press that shutter button or even program it to, you know, do it automatically without having to physically touch the camera. So you avoid that shakiness that we were talking about earlier. And you can tell it to take as many shots as you want. So depending on what kind of camera you have, most newer cameras do have a built-in intervalometer. Like my Canon R7, it has a built-in one, and I can set it to do an unlimited number of photos for, you know, 15 seconds each with a 1 second delay between each one. So you refer to your manual if you need to, but go into your menu and I want you to basically go ahead and set it to take 60 shots one after another with as low of a delay as possible in between one of the next shots. So like for my camera, you have to do a 1 second delay between each shot. You can't set it to zero. And what we're going to do here by taking one shot after another like this, so 15 second exposures over the next 60 photos, we're going to end up with 15 minutes of exposures. And if we were to import that 15 minutes of exposure into an app on Windows or Mac that allows you to create a time-lapse video, we can then see the stars move across the night sky in a really awesome video, which is, you know, super fun to use. You could put it on Facebook, you could put it on Instagram, etc. And it's a really easy way to get started that is quite beautiful. So, you know, 15 minutes, that's going to be like a really short video, just a couple, 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds long, depending on how much you speed it up. Me personally, when I like to do time-lapse videos, I try to get at least 2 or 3 hours worth of exposures. So that way you can see, you know, a really long stretch of different constellations coming and going throughout the photo itself. So I hope this helps. I know it's pretty simple. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about a different method that you can use for unguided with no star tracker nighttime photography. You are listening to the Astrocast. I'm your host, Rue. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Astrocast. I'm your host, Rue. Today we are talking about astrophotography basics as far as just using a tripod and a camera or a phone to do time-lapse photography. I wanted to just quickly mention a free app on Windows that you can use to actually take those photos and turn it into to a time-lapse video, because you do have to actually combine them and say each one of those photos is going to be a frame in a video. And that app is called ClipChamp. So if you go to the Microsoft App Store on your Windows PC and just do a search for ClipChamp, what you'll be able to do is import all of those photos into one video in ClipChamp and then shorten the length of each one of them to about, let's say, a tenth of a second to get started. And then you can, you know, speed it up or slow it down as you see fit, and then have them all play one after another. And that is what creates the illusion of a time lapse, the constellations moving across the sky in a, you know, a quick succession. So the last thing I want to discuss that we can do with just a simple camera and a tripod, or phone and a tripod, if you will, is something that you can do in the summertime sky. And you can even do it in the wintertime sky. But for our purposes, we're going to talk about doing it in the summertime sky because it's a little bit more dramatic and breathtaking, if you will. And that is Milky Way core photography. So let's say that it is July and it's around 10 o'clock at night. What I want you to do is take your tripod and your camera, and I want you to find a clear southern horizon. Again, this is if you're in the northern hemisphere. We'll talk about southern hemisphere. I'm actually going to have a guest on the show, hopefully in the near future, who is from the southern hemisphere, and we can get into the specifics of the times of year, which are the opposite, obviously, from the northern hemisphere, but that's a different topic for a different day. So northern hemisphere, summertime, July, it's about 10 o'clock at night. You've got a clear southern horizon. I want you to set up that tripod. I want you to take your camera and go ahead and mount it and point it towards the south. You can get rather low on the horizon, and it would be ideal to have a wider angle lens for what we're going to attempt here. In this case, we can talk as if we're still using a 16 millimeter lens, but you can use any lens that you have. Even if you just have a kit lens, maybe you got like a, you know, a 16 to 35 or a 75 to 300 kit lens. Just put it on your camera and get the widest field of view that you can, and then point that at the southern sky. And you want to go ahead and focus your stars in the same way that we talked about earlier. So zoom in on one of the brighter stars on your camera and adjust that focus ring until you have it as small as possible. And then let's go ahead and go into the settings, and we're going to use very similar settings to what we used before, saying we're using a 16 millimeter lens. Let's set the ISO a little bit higher this time to get started, and you'll see why shortly. Let's try ISO 3200. We're going to do a shutter speed of 15 seconds, and then again, the widest aperture possible. So maybe f1.8, maybe f2.4. If you're using a kit lens, maybe it's f5.6. That's okay. Just make it as wide open as you can and get those stars as sharp as possible. And then let's go ahead and set that 2 second delay like we talked about earlier, so you can press the shutter button down without having to shake the camera. And again, while pointing it at the southern sky, press that shutter button, step back, let it expose for 15 seconds. And then when you see the preview pop up on the screen, you should see something rather breathtaking. If you're in a dark sky, which hopefully you are, but even if you're in, you know, suburban, you know, Bortle 6 or 7 skies, you should still be able to see quite clearly the Milky Way on the horizon going overhead. And the first time that I did this with a friend at a dark site, he was just blown away. He was aghast at what he saw. He said, "Oh my God, my camera took this photo." That was literally the words that he used. And yes, you can get absolutely breathtaking Milky Way photos as simply as that. Tripod, camera, 15 second exposure pointed at the right part of the sky. You know, if you can do that, you can take amazing astrophotography shots. If you're into it, you know, you can even look into stacking those photos on top of each other. There's lots of free software out there that you can use. Deep Sky Stacker is one that comes to mind, to stack those photos on top of each other and then bring out more and more color in the Milky Way and more detail, which is something that we're going to cover in another episode very soon, when we start getting into the meat of how astrophotography and processing is done. But for a lot of people who are just getting started, that is the best advice I could give, would be to start with Milky Way photography. It's simple. It's beautiful. It's something that you can share with friends and family that will really blow them away if they've never seen this type of work before. And a lot of people have not, trust me. I speak from experience in showing some of those photos. When we took our dark sky trip, I have four separate targets. I had the Lagoon Nebula, the Eagle Nebula, Rho Ophiuchus, and then one other target that I can't remember, the Catspaw Nebula. And they all came out absolutely beautiful, and I made large prints of them and sold several. But everybody's favorite picture from that dark sky trip that we took, by far, was a photo that we took where me and my friend walked about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet in front of the camera, and both were looking up, and I was pointing in the direction of the Milky Way. So what we did was we set a 10-second delay on the camera, and we already had, you know, all the settings right, and we had the focus good on the stars. And I pressed the button, and then me and my buddy, we ran up and got into place, and we kind of, you know, took our positions. I pointed up at the night sky, and we heard the shutter open, and we held as perfectly still as possible as we could for those 10 seconds while the camera was exposing. And when I got back and saw, we had a perfect silhouette of me and him looking up, and just an absolutely gorgeous Milky Way covering the entire sky directly above us. And that is something that is just impossible to explain how amazing it is when you see something like that for the first time. So I would highly encourage anyone and everyone to give that a try if you have the equipment available to you. And we'll be right back after this short break, and we'll talk about one more thing before we get out of here. You're listening to the Astrocast, and my name's Rue. Thank you so much for joining us this week for the Astrocast. I just wanted to thank everyone who tuned in last week for our first episode and who may be finishing up this second episode. Thank you so much for tuning in and, you know, giving me a chance to, you know, entertain you for hopefully 1 hour at a time of astronomy and astrophotography related content for the week. I do want you to know that this season we have several awesome interviews coming up with people that you will be very interested to hear from if you've ever been curious about various different aspects of astronomy and astrophotography that you might not get to see on a nightly basis. You'll definitely want to tune in. So stay tuned for all of that and a whole lot more. Next week, we are going to get deeper into the processing side of astrophotography. We're going to talk about different applications that can be used. We're going to talk about free versions. We're going to talk about paid versions. We're going to talk about stacking software, and we're going to talk about Adobe and Lightroom and everything in between. So if that is of interest to you, make sure you tune in next week, and we'll be sure to cover all those bases. You have been listening to the Astrocast. My name is Rue. I'm your host. Thanks so much again for tuning in, and we will talk to you next week. Clear skies.